From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After co-creating one of the most successful sitcoms in TV history, Seinfeld, Larry David is now the star of his own hit, the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's now in its third season. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Larry David. Also, Christopher Lloyd talks about producing and writing for Frasier. And film critic John Powers reviews Michael Moore's new documentary, Bowling for Columbine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Members of Congress reacted with shock and sadness to the death of Minnesota Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone. Wellstone, along with his wife, daughter, and five other people, was killed in a plane crash in northern Minnesota today. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Wellstone was an unapologetic liberal known for his disheveled appearance and his fiery floor speeches, and he was a loyal lieutenant to Massachusetts Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy, on whose Labor and Health Committee Wellstone served. Kennedy was actually in Minnesota Friday to campaign for Wellstone and other Democrats.
Paul Wellstone had a passion for the good things for people, and he expressed it brilliantly on the floor of the United States Senate and here in Minnesota.
Even Republicans with whom Wellstone frequently disagreed praised him for never abandoning his core beliefs. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Maryland will be the first jurisdiction to bring murder charges against two men suspected of carrying out the sniper attacks. 41-year-old John Allen Muhammad and 17-year-old John Lee Malvo were arrested early yesterday. Prosecutor Doug Gansler says Montgomery County, Maryland, is filing charges of 6 counts of first-degree murder. He says authorities from various jurisdictions have been working to make sure the suspects, if convicted, get what they deserve.
As a group, the prosecutors involved in the investigation remain united in the cause to ensure that justice is served, that these men are held accountable for the acts that they allegedly committed, and that the punishment ultimately meted out fits the crime.
Alabama has filed murder charges against Muhammad and Malvo for crimes committed last month. The suspects are being held without bail. Chechen rebels are demanding that Russia declare its war with Chechnya over. Otherwise, they say, they will start killing hostages at sunrise. There has already been one confirmed death. Hundreds of people are being held captive in a theater seized Wednesday. As NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports, anxious relatives were aware of the threat through phone calls from some of the hostages.
Earlier today, some of the people, the relatives standing outside the theater who've been anxiously waiting for the relatives, said that they've been receiving phone calls on cell phones from inside the theater from their relatives, who said they'd been told to relay a message by the hostage takers that they were prepared to start shooting hostages early tomorrow morning if their demands are not met. And of course, we know their main demand is the withdrawal of Russian forces from Chechnya. They say they want to see evidence of a pullout.
NPR's Lawrence Sheets reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 126 points to 8,443 in heavy volume of about 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed up 32 points to 1,331. This is NPR. President Bush and Chinese President Jiang Zemin say they will cooperate to persuade North Korea to become nuclear-free. The two leaders vowed to seek a peaceful resolution to the crisis sparked when North Korea announced it has a nuclear weapons program. Irish actor Richard Harris died today in a London hospital. NPR's Bob Mondello reports.
Richard Harris wanted to be a director, but his booming voice and massive presence made him a natural stage actor, and from there it was a short hop into films. He created a sensation in This Sporting Life as a rugby-playing coal miner, and later specialized in roistering characters with hot tempers, from Cain in John Huston's The Bible, to A Man Called Horse, to feisty Bull McCabe in The Field, which won him an Oscar nomination. Harris's recording of the song MacArthur Park earned him a Grammy nomination, and he toured for years in the stage musical Camelot after playing King Arthur in the screen version. His most recent parts were as sages. He told interviewers he took the role of wizard Albus Dumbledore in the Harry Potter movies because his granddaughter threatened to stop speaking to him if he didn't. Richard Harris was 72. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
Mexico's popular tourism site of Puerto Vallarta is struggling through a devastating storm. Hurricane Kenna hit the country's Pacific coast today. It knocked down power lines and trees. The hurricane, which packed winds of 140 miles per hour, was described as one of the strongest storms to hit the area in decades. Recapping the figures on Wall Street, the Dow closed up 126 points at 8,443. NASDAQ also up 32 at 1,331. This is NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Fearsome Doubt, an Inspector Ian Rutledge mystery by Charles Todd, author of Watchers of Time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most people don't want to admit how selfish and annoying they can be, but not Larry David. He plays himself on his HBO sitcom Curb Your Enthusiasm, and the show is all about how neurotic and self-centered he is and how difficult he is to be around. But this works because the show is very funny. No surprise there. Larry David was head writer, executive producer, and co-creator of Seinfeld. The character of George was based in part on Larry David. The actor who played George, Jason Alexander, plays himself on Larry David's show. In this episode from last season, Jason Alexander was complaining to Larry David that the only roles he was getting offered were characters like George. That's the only way people in Hollywood see him when he meets with them.
I go in and I talk to them and I try to present differently, but they see the idiot. They see the schmuck.
Well, what do you mean schmuck? I don't get that. What do you mean schmuck?
The yutz, the idiot, you know.
No, I frankly, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why you say he's a schmuck and a yutz and an idiot. I don't see him that way at all. I just see him as funny.
I mean, of course it was funny, but he was the fall guy. He was the jackass role. He was, this is the guy that never got the girl, and he finally gets the girl,
what?
And he kills her with the envelope and the... doesn't know what he wants.
That's funny. That's not schmucky. That's funny.
What is more jerky or putzy than going to a girl's house and stealing a tape out of her answering machine?
I went to a girl's house and took a tape out of an answering machine.
Larry, he's eaten eclairs out of a garbage can?
Yeah, so what? I ate an eclair out of the garbage can. So what?
Masturbation contest for people?
I was in a contest, and you know I was in that masturbation contest.
All right, fine.
So what? I'm a schmuck for being in a masturbation contest?
It's not an incredibly noble experiment, was it?
Well, I'm sorry that you hate the character so much.
I don't hate the character. I'm a little tired of it.
It's a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. In 1992, I asked Larry David about creating the character of George.
Well, George is pretty much based on me.
Describe the character for our listeners who haven't seen the show.
Except I'm a lot sicker than George is.
More neurotic? Wow.
Yes. I would love to have George's life. Describe George's character?
Yeah.
Well, he's just a person who has difficulty in getting up in the morning and putting his clothes on. And starting from there, everything else is a problem for him. Particularly women.
Yes, this
having
is
a relation.
This is the kind of guy who, when he finally gets to go home with a woman who he's really interested in, he finds out that the bathroom's right next to the bedroom and he has a nervous stomach and the whole thing is horribly embarrassing, so he has to leave.
So he leaves, exactly, yeah.
Did this come out of your life?
I have to say, yes, it did come out of my life. And I did, and I did leave, yeah. But I managed to patch things up with her the next day.
You explain?
I never really got into detail about it, no, but I did patch things up.
Now, Jerry Seinfeld seems pretty unneurotic for a comic.
Yes, that's true. That's true. He's an anomaly. Seinfeld is. And I don't know how he got that way. I would switch places with him in a second.
Now, you used to do stand-up.
Yes, that's true.
When did you start doing it, and what was your act like?
I started doing it in 1975, and it's hard to describe what my act was like, because very often I would leave in the middle of it. As soon as I saw somebody in the audience just make a face or somebody talk to the person next to them, I would become infuriated and throw the microphone down and leave.
That was it? You just not
and
come
I would,
back?
I would get in fights with the audience if they weren't laughing. I was like the McEnroe of comedy. I couldn't stand adversity. Yeah, but that's pretty much what would happen. I would be in the middle of a show, and I would just walk off.
So with a reputation like that, who would hire you?
Nobody. And see, no one. No one would hire me. But I did, I was able to perform at the showcase clubs. Because they liked me. They didn't care if I walked off.
They probably weren't paying you anyways, right?
That's exactly the point.
Right.
Yeah, they weren't.
Why would you walk off? Why were you so easily discouraged when somebody wouldn't laugh or would heckle?
Because I'm a baby. I'm a big baby, and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand like losing. It was like winning and losing. And if I lost to the audience, I couldn't take it. I would throw the board over.
Well, did you ever kill on stage?
Oh yes. Yeah, I did. Yeah, very, very often, in fact.
And you'd complete those sets?
Those I would complete, yeah. And that was always an exhilarating feeling for me.
So what was your act like?
It wasn't anything like Jerry's. First of all, it was completely disjointed, very eclectic. I would talk about a lot of really... really personal things, and also a lot of farcical, absurd things. And I can't really say what it was about. It was mostly about me, I guess.
Give me a sense of something really personal that you'd reveal about yourself in the act.
Do you want me to tell you something?
Sure.
Oh, gee. Oh. I don't know. I guess... oh, impotency, maybe. Not that I'm impotent now, but perhaps I would talk about an experience that I had. Things like that.
Well, this helps give me a sense of why you'd walk off. I mean, really, if you're revealing things that are pretty personal and somewhat embarrassing and somebody doesn't laugh, I could see why you might want to leave.
Oh, so you could understand that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, see, there you go.
Yeah, because a lot of comics aren't that personal.
No, well, I don't know. It's hard for me to describe my act. I don't really know what it was. It was a lot of the things that you see on the show too. Also, a lot of the situations would you could find in my act, I think.
You were with Saturday Night Live for 84 to 85, is that right?
Yes, one season.
Mm-hmm. Which season was that? Who was the cast? Who were in the cast?
Billy Crystal and Christopher Guest, Martin Short was that year.
Uh-huh. What were some of the sketches you wrote?
They only put on the air one sketch of mine the entire season.
Which one?
No one in the world wouldn't know what it was, except maybe a few people in my family. The sketch was on, it was the last sketch of a show that Ed Begley Jr. was the host of. And the sketch was on at 5 to 1 in the morning. And Ed Begley Jr. played an architect. And Harry Shearer was the developer. And Harry Shearer was looking over the plans for the new building that Ed Begley had designed. And he saw He said he was looking over the blueprint, and he said to Ed Begley, what's this thing over here? And Ed Begley said, oh, that's the elevator. And then Harry Shearer said, no, but what's this? And he said, oh, that's a stool for the elevator man to sit. And then Harry Shearer said that a stool? He didn't want his elevator men sitting on stools. And they just got in a fight, and that that was the sketch. It's pretty stupid.
I don't remember it.
No, I'm sure you don't.
Yeah. How is it that you worked there for a whole year and or a whole season and only got one sketch on?
Because Dick Ebersol didn't like my material. He was the executive producer. Dick and I didn't quite get along. Dick and I had a few problems.
Did you feel like what's the point of staying if your material isn't going to get on?
Yes, yes. In fact, I actually quit the show, and there's a Seinfeld episode that's based on this. One day I walked into Ebersol's office. It was like right before one of the shows was about to start. He had cut one of my sketches after dress rehearsal. And I walked up to him right before airtime, 10 minutes before airtime, and I walked up to myself. That's it. I'm finished. I quit. I've had it. I'm never coming back here again. It's over. Over. Done. I hate this place. I quit. So I left. I left the building, and I started walking home, and I felt very good. I quit the show. I wasn't going to put up with that. And I got home, and I started thinking about my salary and how much money I was giving up. And I go, let's see, that's 3,000 there, that 15, 25, that $40,000. What am I out of my mind? I'm going to give this guy $40,000. It's another couple of weeks. What am I, crazy? You know? So on Monday morning, I went back in and pretended that the whole thing never happened. And I went into the meeting. I said good morning to everybody. People gave me some strange looks. And Ebersol never said another word to me about it, so I just continued working there. But I wrote an episode for Seinfeld about it last year when George quit his job.
So when did you decide that you wanted to do comedy?
When I got out of college, I took a few acting classes. And I was so bad as an actor. I was such a terrible actor but I was making people laugh with my asides that they were encouraging me to become a comedian.
What gave you the confidence to get up on stage? It sounds like you're not the most confident guy.
No, I had no confidence to go up on stage, and I still don't have any confidence to go up on stage. And I am not the most confident guy, you're right. But I had nothing in my life. There was nothing else that I was capable of doing. And I was really perhaps on the verge of becoming a homeless person at some point, so I felt like I had nothing to lose, so I got up there. I put a gun to my head and got up there is what I did.
So you were saying that you might do comedy again when the show ends.
Yes, I might. I'm considering it.
Do you think you'd have a more confident attitude if you did comedy again?
No, not at all. I don't think so. I don't think it makes a difference. I watch Jerry. It's like he could be talking to you, and then all of a sudden he's talking to them. With me, if I know I'm going on that night, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I start thinking about it, and you can't even talk to me for the whole day. I don't have an appetite, and it takes a lot of mental energy for me to prepare myself to go up there.
Larry David, thanks a lot for talking with us. And if I ever get the chance to see you perform live, I'll be sure to laugh.
Yeah, either that or bring your earplugs or a bulletproof vest or something. Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Larry David recorded in 1992. His HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm is now in its third season. This is Fresh Air. Some people assume that because we work in public radio, we look down on TV. And boy, that is not true. The Fresh Air crew loves to watch good shows, and we love having on the people behind them. We try to bring you the most interesting people in every part of American culture. Famous, infamous, popular, marginalized, confident, neurotic. As long as they're doing interesting, really interesting good work. Please support this with a pledge. Thank you. The Bernie Mac Show starts its new season Wednesday. We're going to hear from the show's star, Bernie Mac, who plays a fictional version of himself. Both Bernie Macs are stand-up comics. The real Bernie Mac became well-known through the Russell Simmons Deaf Comedy Jam on HBO and Spike Lee's performance film, The Original Kings of Comedy. I spoke with him last year. You grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Yes, ma'am.
Describe where you grew up.
I was born on 66 and Blackstone, and that building was torn down because it was rat infested. We couldn't play outside because the rats used to be in the walls on the banisters. We stayed on the third floor, and my mom used to literally pick me up. I was 3 to 4 years old, and she would walk me 3 flights of stairs and kicking rats from my feet. The city tore the building down and moved us to 69th and Morgan. Well, that was a little bit better, supposedly, the Inglewood area in Chicago. And at 4 years old, that's when I, 4 to 5, decided I wanted to be a comedian because I walked in from playing and I saw my mother sitting in her favorite chair crying. And as a little kid, I saw her cry and I began to cry, like most kids often do. And I asked her why was she crying and she told me nothing. At that particular time, Ed Sullivan was introducing Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby came out and he did a routine about rats and snakes in the bathroom. My mother began to laugh and cry at the same time. When I saw that, I started laughing with her. And I told my mom, I said, that's what I'm going to be, Mom. I'm going to be a comedian. So I'll never have to see you cry again. Because at that particular time, I thought comedians relieve my mother of her pain. And that's something that I always wanted to do.
So what were some of the jokes that went over real big when you were a boy?
I think none. I think that I was a struggling comic, but in my mind, I was successful. People said I was stupid. I was silly. They said I was buffoonish. I used to dress up, put on my mother wig, put on my grandmother slip coat. I used to dress up as a woman and portray as Bernice. That was one of the characters that I created as a young boy, was Bernice. And it wasn't about being a homosexual or anything like that. I was portraying a woman. And I used to talk like a woman, put on my grandmother's glasses, and I used to mimic, y'all better quit playing up in here. Everybody better go to bed. I'm sick and tired of all this mess. Lord, Lord, Lord. And that's how my grandma used to talk.
Now, when you were getting started, did you play different kinds of audiences, some black audiences, some white audiences, some integrated audiences?
I performed whatever there was people. I started on the L's of Chicago. In the 70s, I used to ride the L's and perform from 95th Street all the way downtown. I used to do the subways.
Wait. No, in New York subways have been almost like performance art, where every 5 minutes someone else is coming in and either doing some performance or asking for money or telling you that they're, you know, threatening you unless you give them money. But there's always something. So how would you do it? You just walk into a car and start doing your
act? No, I never walked to a car. No, I never did that. What I used to do was, during the rush hour, people go to work, I would get on the end of the L, and I would go and I would always watch the news and I would read the paper and see what was going on in the city. And I would get on and people would first look at me like I was a bum until they got acquainted with me and they got familiar with me. And they said, oh, this guy, this is the L comedian. And I used to make people laugh and I had a box. and people used to put money in the box. Then when I got to Lake Street, I should go way down in the subway, and as people be going back and forth, I would stand there, and I had this little microphone, little beatbox thing, and it was like my speaker, and I would tell jokes, and I would talk about current events, things that happened in the neighborhood, and plus I would do little characters and stuff that I had back then, and people would throw money in the box. I made $300 to $400 a day.
Wow, that's great.
But I
was probably more
happy
than some of the comedy cups played.
Yeah, but I wasn't happy.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't happy at all because I felt like I was begging. I felt like a bum.
Right.
I wanted to be legitimized. In 1977, I went to the clubs.
Did you find that white audiences and black audiences reacted differently to your material or reacted differently in general?
Well, they act different in general because white audience come to be entertained. Black audience want to entertain you. And white audience are more cordial, more respectful of the artist. And even if you're bad, I mean, you know, the audience has changed. I'm talking about the audience back then.
Mm-hmm.
The audience has changed all the way around the table now. But white audience was more cordial to you. Black audience, they just tell you like it is. If you suck, you suck. And they don't want to hear. You ain't getting nothing but 2 or 3 minutes. You come out the gate with that old sorry stuff, you're in a world of trouble.
Well, how would you get driven off the stage if you weren't working?
I refused to get driven off the stage.
Okay.
When I suffered, when I died the death of a pilot, I stayed up there. And that was something I think that helped me to this day.
Bernie Mac recorded last year. The new season of The Bernie Mac Show premieres next Wednesday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writing for the two most stereotypical gay characters on TV who aren't gay, we talk with Christopher Lloyd about producing and writing for Frasier. And film critic John Powers reviews Michael Moore's new documentary, Bowling for Columbine.
Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Half a Life by V.S. Naipaul, author of Enigma of Arrival and A House for Mr. Biswas.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Moore turns his personal, confrontational filmmaking style on the subject of gun violence in his new documentary, Bowling for Columbine. It won the 55th Anniversary Jury Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Moore is best known for his 1989 film, Roger and Me, and his bestseller, Stupid White Men. Film critic John Powers has a review.
It says something comical about the disarray of the left in America, that its most famous figure is not a political candidate or charismatic activist like Martin Luther King. It's a media character, Michael Moore, whose ball cap, burgeoning belly, and wise guy populism have made him not merely the left's answer to Rush Limbaugh, but an international brand name. Bowling for Columbine is his most ambitious work, a personal study of American gun violence, and in a larger sense, of American violence itself. Moore's investigation finds him shambling around Colorado, Los Angeles, Canada, and his old hometown of Flint, Michigan. Along the way, he has some funny encounters. In one, he gets a free gun from a bank by signing up for a CD. And some encounters filled with melancholy, as when he meets two kids who were shot at Columbine. Moore interviews deluded Michigan militiamen, Kmart PR people, the producer of the TV show Cops, and several amiable Canadians, whose country has the same high level of gun ownership as the U.S., but a far lower rate of murder. Here, Moore talks to rock star Marilyn Manson, whose music has been blamed by some for causing teen violence.
The two byproducts of that whole tragedy were violence and entertainment and gun control. And how perfect that that was the two things that we were going to talk about with the upcoming election. And also, then we forgot about Monica Lewinsky. We forgot about the president was shooting bombs overseas, yet I'm a bad guy because I've sang some rock and roll songs. And who's a bigger influence, the president or Marilyn Manson?
Do you know?
I'd like to think me, but I'm going to go with the president.
Do you know that the day that Columbine happened, the United States dropped more bombs on Kosovo than any other time during that war?
I do know that.
Violence lies, sad to say, at the very heart of this nation's experience, as the whole D.C. area sniper story reminds us. One reason why Bowling for Columbine is finding some loyal admirers is that Moore raises the kind of larger questions about American society that never seem to come up in our TV coverage, which remains obsessed with tree trunks and FBI profilers, never root causes. Moore raises such good questions that I kept wishing he'd slow down and try to answer them. But he's better at scoring easy political points than at giving us a clear vision of things. In fact, he has the gifts of a good ad man, but he's a slipshod filmmaker. The movie brings up, but never links up, familiar ideas. The demonizing of black men, fear-mongering TV news, Canada's government healthcare system, and the Bush administration's partisan use of fear. At once punchy and incoherent, the film has the scattershot shapelessness of a concept album made by a singles band. And the style is the man. Moore takes delight in thumping tabloid TV, but he himself uses its cheap techniques and manipulative heartlessness. When a school principal breaks into tears, Moore sensitively puts his arm around her, but keeps the camera running. Even worse, his idea of social analysis is to play Louis Armstrong's Wonderful World over footage of countries where the U.S. government has made war or toppled governments, Iran, Guatemala, Afghanistan, etc., and then to end this montage with shots of the planes hitting the World Trade Center. What's rotten here isn't the suggestion that U.S. policy was often reprehensible. It obviously was. Or to suggest that such behavior is part of the context that has triggered anti-Americanism. Ditto. The problem is lazy thinking. Is Moore really suggesting that Osama ever gave a hoot what happened to Salvadoran campesinos? When Moore significantly reminds Manson about the heavy bombing of Kosovo on the same day as Columbine, you wonder what his point is. Does he really think U.S. foreign policy caused those two kids to gun down their schoolmates? Or that the bombing of Kosovo is somehow the same as those high school murders? Near the end, Moore goes after NRA President Charlton Heston, who we've earlier seen, not altogether appealingly, firing up the faithful at a pro-gun rally in Denver immediately after the Columbine shootings. Flashing his own NRA membership card, Moore visits the actor's Beverly Hills mansion and asks Moses why he thinks there's so much gun violence in America. Heston ventures a couple of answers, but Moore isn't satisfied and keeps hectoring him until the aging Heston slowly walks off. Moore chases after him and confronts him with the photo of a 6-year-old girl who'd recently been shot in Flint. Moments later, Moore walks down Heston's driveway, head solemnly lowered. We're clearly supposed to think him the dead girl's champion and voice, the ball-capped, pot-bellied representative of ordinary folks. Me, I kept thinking how low Moore had been to badger a gaga old man for failing to explain why so many Americans shoot one another when his own movie had so transparently failed to answer the very same question.
John Powers writes the On column for LA Weekly. Coming up, writing for the sitcom Frasier. This is Fresh Air. Frasier is one of the funniest and most honored TV programs of our time. It won an unprecedented 5 consecutive Emmys for Outstanding Comedy Series. Kelsey Grammer stars as Frasier Crane, a neurotic and pretentious psychiatrist who hosts a radio call-in show. Even more neurotic and pretentious is Frasier's younger brother Niles, played by David Hyde Pierce. John Mahoney co-stars as their father Martin, who lives with Frasier. Christopher Lloyd was the show's executive producer and also wrote for the series. He recently left to start the new sitcom Bram and Alice, which premiered earlier this month. I spoke with Lloyd in 2000. We started with a scene from Frasier. Frasier's producer is on vacation. Her substitute is an African-American woman. After Frasier encourages her to occasionally say a few words on the air, she ends up giving callers her own homespun advice on love and marriage. Frasier is concerned she's not only taking over his show, she's giving bad advice. But he's afraid to say anything to her. He comes home and explains his problem to his father and brother. They think he's afraid to confront her because she's black, and he's worried he'll sound like a racist. Here's Niles.
For heaven's sake, Frasier, why don't you just talk to her?
Well, it's a delicate situation, Niles, for God's sakes. I mean, it's not all that easy. I mean, she is new to the field. She's sensitive. She's eager to please.
She's black.
Dad, please.
Well, you know damn well that's what this whole thing's about. I don't know what the big deal is. If she's talking too much, just tell her to shut her big bazoo.
Oh, really? And how do you suggest I accomplish that without sounding like a complete bigot?
Well, perhaps a little diplomacy is in order.
Oh, are you saying I should just choose my words more carefully? Is that it?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, fine, fine. All right, Niles. Just exactly how would that go? Why don't you play me and I'll be Mary?
All right, Mary.
Frasier.
I've been meaning to speak to you. You know, people listen to the show for my expertise.
Oh, so my opinion's not worth anything?
Well, I'm the one with the medical degree. Now, I want you to contribute, but only up to a point.
So you want me to stay in my place? Massa!
She's not going to say Massa.
What, am I getting too uppity for you? You sherry-swilling, opera-loving, Armani-wearing elitist? You have no idea how difficult it is for a black woman in a white man's world.
Frasier.
I don't think so. Look at me. This is ridiculous. I have walked myself straight into a minefield.
Christopher Lloyd, was this a difficult subject to take on? Dealing with race is so loaded.
It was. In fact, just sort of dealing with any politically oriented stories we've stayed away from for the most part in 7 years. For whatever reason, it seems to sort of divide people or get people kind of agitated. And so we have really not done any issue shows per se, but this is one that we were kind of intrigued by, just because these guys are so rarefied and so white, and I think a lot of people probably thought that this was in response to the kind of call for greater diversity on television, which it wasn't, although it kind of played into that a little bit, in the sense that it is such a touchy subject, and Frasier is sort of the perfect person to be made especially touchy by it. So we spent a long time, you know, wondering, is this really funny, or is this just kind of uncomfortable? Is it going to make viewers uncomfortable? But I think we walked the line pretty well with it, because it was true. It was a white guy saying, I have this African-American woman working for me. I don't like what she's doing, and I do not know how to tell her that without sounding like a bigot. And he struggled with that, and I think people laughed at it because it was a very real-seeming situation.
Let me play a clip from the Frasier Valentine's Day episode. And this was the story of Frasier and his father going to the opera. And at the opera, they strike up a conversation with a woman Frasier's age who's at the opera with her mother. And Frasier wants to date the woman who's his age, but the problem is the older woman wants to date Frasier's father, and Frasier's father isn't interested. But Frasier has warned his father not to do anything that would alienate the mother, because it would ruin Frasier's chances with the daughter. So here's Frasier's father and the older woman who's interested in him conversing at the opera.
Lovely production, isn't it? Mm. I adore Verdi.
Oh, he's my favorite.
Though the woman singing Gilda's a bit off.
She's no Renata Tibaldi.
You know, if you like Verdi so much, I happen to have a spare ticket to Aida next week.
Oh, that sounds great. But if it's a week from tonight, I'm busy. I'm sorry.
Actually, it's next Thursday.
Oh, Thursday. Oh, you know, there's this thing at my my wine club.
Oh, that's all right, Martin. We just met. I shouldn't have asked.
Oh, no, Helen. It's got nothing to do with you. It's me. I'm afraid I've given you the wrong impression of myself. You see, the truth is, I'm
gay.
Right. Gay.
I thought you might be. How many straight men remember Renata Tibaldi?
Not many.
Well, I'm sorry if I was too forward. It's just that sometimes it's so hard to meet nice men.
Tell me.
No, this is a very funny episode. Was this a kind of sensitive issue to deal with at all?
Yes and no. It's not entirely virgin territory for us. We did a show in the second season, for example, that also explored the a similar theme called The Matchmaker, which had to do with Frasier. Frasier on a date sort of with his the station manager who is gay.
He doesn't think it's a date. Let me explain what's happening. Frasier invites his boss over to dinner with the hopes of matching him up with Daphne, the live-in physical therapist. Frasier doesn't realize his boss is really gay, and his boss has interpreted the invitation as a kind of intimate overture, you know, like a date. You know, and he's expecting an intimate dinner with Frasier, and comedy ensues. It's a very funny episode.
Thank you. And written by the same gentleman who wrote the one that you're talking about, the opera show. His name is Joe Keenan. He's a fabulous writer.
Well, what makes it particularly funny on Frasier, too, is that Frasier and his brother Niles are written almost like the stereotype of gay characters. You know, they love opera, fine wine, home decorating, refined language. They're kind of snobbish. You know, I mean, that's like the stereotype of a certain type of middle-class professional gay character. So when people mistake them for one of them for being gay, it kind of just like fits in with a stereotype.
There was an article in a British newspaper a couple of weeks ago that described Frasier and Niles as heterosexual sissies. I think that comes pretty close to describing what we're after. And I have to say, I think we all kind of resist the stereotype, the idea that just because these guys like the finer things in life, the clothes and the wine, and are cultured, that necessarily, that suggests that they're gay. And sort of by extension, people have said Frasier seems to be written with a gay sensibility. Well, I'm not sure exactly what that means. We've always had gay writers on staff, but we've always had straight writers on staff, too. And just because we like kind of more of a verbal orientation, you know, we use big words and the characters are witty. I'm not sure how that got translated into a gay sensibility exactly, but...
I'm wondering if it's almost easier to write these kind of traits for straight men because then you can't be accused of creating a stereotypical gay character.
I guess that's possible. I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, Niles, neither one of them is gay. Neither one of the characters is. And there's you know, Niles is in love with his wife in the first four or five seasons of the show and at the same time nursing a crush on Daphne. I mean, that, I think, sets him apart from a homosexual character right there. Frasier is constantly on the prowl for women. So I think it's a little unfair to say that they're, you know, they're gay in everything but, you know, the admission of it.
There was an episode in which there's a new doctor who's joined the radio station, you know, doing a phone-in advice show. And one of the things he prides himself on is that, he sings. He loves to sing. Unfortunately, he sings really badly. And to get even with him, Frasier and Niles suggest that he sing at a party. And the song that he sings quite badly, although he doesn't realize how badly he sings, is "Isn't It Romantic," which is it's a great song, and it's not a very well-known song. I thought it was interesting and kind of brave to sing a song that most people probably wouldn't know. And that strikes me as kind of typical of the program. A lot of the jokes and a lot of the situations, they're just very smart, and a lot of shows, I think, would worry, oh, is this going over the listeners' heads? How much do you have to worry about that?
We worry about it less and less. Early on, we would write a joke that used a real, you know, $10 vocabulary word or an obscure reference, and we'd say, gosh, aren't we clever and smart and wonderful, and we've amused ourselves with this, but the audience is never going to get this. We should really dumb this down. And really, Kelsey Grammer was one of the big champions of not doing that and saying the audience is smarter than anyone gives them credit for being. Don't dumb this audience. Don't dumb the material down. Don't write down to the audience. Keep that joke in. They will get it. And a joke that we referred to as a 10% joke, meaning we thought 10% of the audience would get it, would end up getting a big laugh. 60% of the audience would understand it. So we were, I think, a little bit maybe ashamed of that, but also encouraged by it and started writing those sorts of references and jokes more confidently. Just as a footnote, I appreciate your giving us credit for using having the courage to use "Isn't It Romantic," but the reality of it is it's owned by Paramount. We didn't have to pay anything to use this song.
Oh, well.
But I accept the compliment.
Yeah, I thought it was so much more interesting than going with, say, "I Got Rhythm" or,
yeah,
you know.
We've had our share of strange references and musical pieces, but that was not one of them.
I'm wondering if you guys have to keep up with psychiatry. At the risk of ruining these lines, let me read something that Frasier says in one of the episodes. This is the room service episode, one of the mm-hmm. episodes included in the book, The Frasier Scripts. And this is the episode in which Niles, Frasier's brother, ends up sleeping with Frasier's ex-wife, Lilith. And, Frasier finds out about it and is obviously really angry at both Lilith and Niles. And Lilith is trying to, like, explain and rationalize what happened. And Frasier says, "Very impressive, Lilith, but I happen to be a psychiatrist, too. Let me tell you what really transpired. This is a passive-aggressive manifestation of the deep resentments that you both have toward me. You were punishing me for my notoriety, my successful adjustment after our marriage. It is this shared bond that brought you two to your palace of sweet revenge." do you actually try to read?
You can say what's on your mind. Do we all go see psychiatrists? Absolutely. All of us are.
Oh, even a better question
troubled.
Than the one I was going to ask. Do you?
I personally?
Yeah.
I have been known to, as have, I think, a lot of people on our staff. You know, I could tell you it's purely for research purposes. It isn't. But I think we all have a sort of a passing either interest in or dependency on, psychology, psychiatry. Enough to fake it in a script, at any rate, to throw around your passive-aggressive stuff, mumbo-jumbo, your unconscious-conscious distinction, stuff like that.
Christopher Lloyd was an executive producer and writer for Frasier. He recently left to start the new sitcom, Bram and Alice. This is Fresh Air. We love to hear the stories behind the stories from the writers who create the books, movies, and TV shows that become a part of our culture. We think public radio itself has become an important part of America's cultural landscape. I urge you to support it with a pledge. Thank you. It was recently announced that singer-songwriter Warren Zevon, who is 55 years old, has been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. He's a prolific artist known for his dark sense of humor. Zevon has refused chemotherapy and is continuing to record. He told a Los Angeles Times reporter, "It'll be a bummer if I don't make it to see the new James Bond movie." Rhino Records has just released a best-of collection called Genius, the best of Warren Zevon. Rock critic Ken Tucker has these thoughts.
Warren Zevon started out studying classical piano and toured with the Everly Brothers. His self-titled 1976 sophomore album was produced by Jackson Brown and yielded a hit for Linda Ronstadt, Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me, which I'd be tempted to say she never understood the irony of, except that she did some wonderful backup cooing on Zevon's song Excitable Boy. This Rhino Records collection of 22 songs also includes what is, along with Werewolves of London, probably Zevon's best-known song. I went home with the waitress the way I always do. How was I to know she was with the Russians too? Gambling in Havana, I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha! Lawyers, Guns, and Money, first released in 1978, started out as thrilling black humor. Then the title phrase passed into the realm of cliche. But just in time for Zevon's demise, we can look at our present domestic business scandals and foreign policy and hear it as the jaundiced breaking news its author initially conceived of it as being. That's no small achievement right there. I'm very well acquainted with the seven deadly sins. I keep a busy schedule, trying to fit them in. I'm proud to be a glutton, and I don't have time for sloth. I'm greedy and I'm angry and I don't care who I cross. I'm Mr. Bad Example, intruder in the dirt. I like to have a good time and I don't care who gets hurt. I'm Mr. Bad Example, take a look at me. I'll live to be 100 and go down in infamy. Of course I went to... Given that Zevon is an artist wholly without self-pity, or much patience with unearned praise, it should be noted that his recording career has been very uneven, and that his two ex-wives and a lot of people in bars he visited would probably rate him even more unkindly than that.
An alcoholic who's been sober for more than a decade now, Zevon put out quite a bit of junk in the 80s, and this CD shouldn't have bothered to pick up songs from nearly every album he cut. On the other hand, the album also rescues from obscurity some real marvels of hard-boiled storytelling, like one about the boxer Boom Boom Mancini, recorded with members of R.E.M. Over the years, Zevon's wild life, real and imagined, provides lots of vicarious thrills for fans, including David Letterman, who not only invites Zevon to lead his house band when Paul Schaefer takes a night off, but who also has built up a very funny running gag about how after every appearance, he and Zevon get in a car and drive across the country raising hell. Letterman fully appreciates Zevon's power to amuse and disturb people, to throw them off guard by both his complicated vehemence and his stark emotionalism.
Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum. Hoist the mainsail, here I come. Ain't no room on board for the insincere. You're my witness, I'm your mutineer. I was born rock the boat. Some may sink, but we will float. Grab your coat, let's get out here. You're my witness, I'm your mutineer.
It's been reported that Warren Zevon gave his doctor copies of Life Will Kill Ya and My Ride's Here, and said, "These are my last two albums. Maybe now you'll understand that eerie acceptance of death you keep asking me about." I hate to end this on a cliche, but given that the career under discussion has been in part devoted to reinvesting cliches with the truth that originally inspired them, I mean it when I say that when I read Zevon's remarks, I laughed until I cried.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Warren Zevon's new CD, Genius, The Best of Warren Zevon. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Adolph Green singing one of the great lyrics he co-wrote with Betty Comden. Green died yesterday at the age of 87.
New York, New York, a hell of a town. Bronx is up and the battery's down. And people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a hell of a town. We've got one day here and not another minute to see the famous sights. We'll find the romance and danger waiting in it beneath the Broadway lights.
But we've hair on our chest, so what we like the best of the nights.
Sights,
lights,
nights, New York, New York, a hell of a town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. And people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New
York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Left Behind series of novels about the apocalypse and the second coming of Jesus Christ has become a publishing phenomenon. On the next Fresh Air, we meet co-author Tim LaHaye, an influential figure on the Christian right, and journalist Gershom Gorenberg, who has written about the politics and religion of these books. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.